We have a lot of videos of the podcast and various other tutorials on YouTube. You can subscribe to our channel at mixingmusicpodcast.com/YouTube. Happy mixing and enjoy the show.
One, two, three.
Hello and welcome back to the Mix the Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and today with me we have the host of the Ableton Music Producer Podcast, Dan Griffin. What's up, Dan?
What's up, man? How you doing?
Good, good, good. Hey, I'm really glad that you made it to the show. This is an exciting one because I know not all of our listeners use Pro Tools, or they're not all just mixers. In fact, I would say a good majority portion of our listeners are producers, that also dabble in engineering. So this is a good episode for you to jump on. Thank you so much for coming. Do you want to talk a little bit about your podcast, what you do, where you're from, before we kind of get started?
Yeah, man. No, I appreciate you for having me. This will be fun. I'm definitely an Ableton producer nerd of sorts. But yeah, I host the Ableton Music Producer Podcast, like you said. Interview a lot of really interesting people, like Laura Escudé. It's like the first Ableton certified trainer. She's done playback for Kanye and a lot of people like that in the industry. Anybody from like the live side, because Ableton Live is originally made for live performance, for anybody that didn't already know that, to like more the studio side. So yeah, I just get to like pick a bunch of people's brains. And it's been fun because I feel like I've learned a lot in the last 2 years from when I started the podcast, just aimlessly talking in my phone. Just really for my students, for my website that I teach through, Live Producers Online. But then it just eventually people started sharing it. And I was like, wow, I could actually maybe do this for a living. This could be a job of me just randomly talking to people. Like, that's kind of fun. I'm into it now. So yeah, 2.5 years later, almost my full-time job. So count myself pretty blessed to do that. It's a good time.
That is so awesome. I'm sure that there's lots of things that I can learn from you about exactly doing that. So
yeah, same to you.
That's incredible. Thank you so much for joining us. So just a real quick pitch. If Ableton Music Producer Podcast, what is it about? Who's your target audience? Like, who is the prime audience for your show?
Well, first and foremost, obviously Ableton Live users, but we do a lot of things. Like, we've had several guests talk about mixing and mastering in Ableton Live. We've talked about setting up your productions for live performance, like basically taking stems. How do you set them up for major tours or shows, or even smaller shows, whether you're DJing or playing with live instruments? Because you can. There's a lot of different ways of setting up a show, doing what we would call playback, which is really an entire industry in itself now, especially for large touring artists. Being the intermediary between taking their stems from the studio to live performance. So we've had some good guests that I've interviewed talking about that. A lot of nerding out with just audio and MIDI effects. Like, tomorrow I'm releasing a podcast with a house techno producer called Bot. He lives in LA, so you might have heard him, but I think there's a lot of people in LA for sure. But he's pretty dope. He's done a lot of stuff with Dirty Bird and did the like major Kid Cudi Day and Night remix. That went viral, had like 74 million streams. I'm not sure how many of those streams he got royalties for, but he's a super nice guy. We talked about, just as an example to your question, like, we talk about a lot of Ableton Live devices using like spectral resonators, like a new Ableton Live 11 device. It's just freaking crazy.
That's awesome. So it's for producers, it's for potential, what do you call it? The playback engineers.
Yeah.
But I think you said previously, before we start recording, you also talk a little bit about recording and mixing and vocal production, just anything that's in within Ableton. So that's really cool. Are people that don't use Ableton able to understand what's going on?
Yeah, I think so too. I try to keep it kind of high level because, I mean, unless you're screen sharing the whole time, so you can kind of get lost in the sauce of like just being a nerd and going deep into the dark abyss of Ableton, because it is like, it's a black hole, man. Like, you can go pretty deep. I'm still learning stuff all the time about Ableton Live and especially Max for Live. Are you familiar with Max for Live?
I don't know Max for Live.
Yeah. It's like, the best description I ever heard was Ben Casey. He's a brand manager for Ableton. He said it's like digital duct tape. Basically anything that Ableton Live doesn't natively do on its own. Max for Live, you could custom create and code it to happen for you. So like I've even gone to like Loop a couple years ago. That's like Ableton's conference that they host every few years. And that was the last one in person was in LA. I think it was like 4 years ago. But the one guy was using Max for Live in Ableton just to like program robots, just like for like motion and movement and stuff. Yeah, pretty crazy. So there's a lot you could do with it. There's always something to learn, which is like why I love the whole podcasting thing. I feel like, especially as like a music producer, like anybody who's producing music, you know that like you kind of have to step away from music at times. And that's, I feel like, one reason podcasting is so great.
Well, that's super awesome. So if you want to check out, if that sounds interesting to you, go check out Ableton Music Podcast. Oh, Ableton Music Producer Podcast.
Yeah.
Let me say that right.
It's a lot of syllables. Yeah.
Let me say it once right in the show.
That's cool. Doing great, dude. Doing great.
But yeah, so Dan, can you tell us a little bit about what a playback engineer is? So to be very fair, I was a professional performer in the early days of my career at one point, but I'm not really a live person. I've gone to one bigger live show. I mean, I've done dozens and dozens of independent, you know, smaller concert series or whatever.
Yeah.
But as far as like live shows, I went to go see Fun at the 930 Club in Washington, D.C. in like 2011.
Nice.
That's like the really only live. So I'm not really a live guy. I've always just been in the studio.
Yeah, that's
fair.
So
I don't know anything about live stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about what the playback engineer is?
Yeah, man, it's you wear a lot of hats. I think it's almost easier to explain what it isn't, honestly. Like when you go to like a major tour, playback engineering is basically working with the artist and front of house and sometimes even the lighting or production team to make sure the sound and everything on stage is being synced up in the way that the artist wants it to happen. So it could be something as simple as like, hey, I'm going to work with the artist in the studio before the show and make sure that the banks on their MIDI controllers that they're playing on stage are switching at the right time for each song, to I'm going to help them make their stems sound better that we got back from the mastering engineer and that the volumes or like the lufs are consistent throughout the entire set, like things like that. So
now how often does that happen? Even with high level, where the label has paid for some nice mastering and mixing, how often are the songs inconsistent for PA playback?
I would say...
Because I would assume most of the mastering that they get is not meant for live playback. It's meant for...
Right, yeah.
And I assume, you have to tell me, I assume the requirements and everything, it just feels a little bit more different in a live room than it is like in your car.
Well, no, then that's a great point too, man, because every speaker system, every venue sounds a little bit different, you know, like you got to work with the room, especially in the studio, like you're referencing the crap out of your mixes before it goes out into the world, right? Because you just never know where people are listening. Same's kind of true for, you know, the live show world, right? On huge systems. So it's kind of a game of like, really expecting the mastering engineer to pull up and try to make everything sound consistent. But I think more often than not, usually as long as the artist, especially at a higher level, like when you're talking about people who are like full-time playback engineers, they're working with mastering engineers who really know what they're doing, you know, and it's not that big of a concern consistently. Usually, you know, a lot of times, hopefully they're working with the same mastering engineer for most of the songs.
I assume all that prepping is done before the show. Like you're not mastering it on the spot.
No. Although, dude, I could tell you stories though, man. Like there's, so Laura Escada, I mentioned her earlier. She's a good friend. And I actually owe a lot to her for learning playback. And she's in LA and she runs a team called Electronic Creatives. And so she only accepts so many people into what she calls her master track. So she accepts like 15 people like every year or two, and then does like intensive comprehensive training on playback and her systems with redundancy, meaning that you have two of everything. So if like one laptop goes down, you're screwed, right? So you have to have double of everything happening at the same time and syncing it up. And so that's where a lot of her secret sauce is with redundancy.
Wow.
Which was really cool to learn her workflow with that. But But yeah, going back to like what you were saying is a lot of it is just working with the artist and being like, okay, how do you want to perform live? Because I'm sure, you know, you say you don't go to tons of shows, but like, I'm sure you've been to a show where you knew a song, right? And you love that song. And then when the artist plays it, it's a little different. And it's like that excitement where you're like, oh shit, this is like new, you know, and you get excited because you already love that track. So I think that's really cool when artists want to take almost kind of a live remix of their stems. That's definitely a playback engineering's job a lot of times. Just be like, okay.
So with one of my favorite performances that I see live, I mean on YouTube, was Bruno Mars performing Perm on the BET Awards like a couple years ago.
Yeah. So
Perm was totally different. It was like more dancey. It was like almost a different song. That was the playback engineer.
Maybe not. I mean, he could have done that in the studio and all pre-programmed it. But a lot of times, if you're making minor tweaks, like, hey, I'm just going to cut out the verse. I want to go straight into the chorus. Like a lot of hard cuts and like that is usually definitely more on the playback engineering side a lot of times, you know.
I see.
But you could do a lot of stuff. Like, for example, I'm not going to name any names, but there was a trio in the country music scene that has won like, I think like 16 Grammys now or something. And I had the opportunity to work with them in Nashville, and we're sitting down and I get all their stems. Half of them were mastered. The other half sounded like a fourth grader mixed it in his garage. And I was kind of like literally had to figure out how to like limit and do quick EQ and then rebounce those stems and really tighten it up. And then they want to do a bunch of cuts and changes with a bunch of MIDI controllers we were syncing up. That was real interesting. So that was a fun crash course on like just getting thrown into the fire and be like, oh, wow, Dan, you got to figure out how to like do 60,000 things in this like 6-hour session that we have today, because they're going on tour for their new album release in a week. So have fun with that. But there's it could be a lot of pressure, man, as a playback engineer for sure. But I think it's been really helpful for me. You know, this is the Mixing Music Podcast, right? So it's been helpful for me to really think about like, how can I mix something the fastest I possibly can and just try to make it sound clean and consistent for, you know, 12 songs in like a 45 minute set or something like that.
That's interesting. So it's like a lot of last minute while you're going type work.
It can
be. Yeah. And I assume there's some prep work that you can do as well.
Sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And anytime I work with an artist like doing playback engineering, I always definitely would like to have all the stems a week in advance before practice, just so I can really listen and set them up for them and have some time to do all that prep and automation.
So you said to practice. So that means like, you part of it is like you set it up to do all those cuts before. Part of it is like doing it on the spot, like you're playing it.
Yeah, it really depends on the band. Like I'm trying to think of a great example. I mean, there's bands like I guess Da Vinci. Do you know who Da Vinci is? He was really famous with the MPC coming up as a finger drummer for them. And he did some playback engineering for Miss Lauryn Hill and some other people. And with her, he was also the drummer and the playback engineer. Like, he finger drums and he also ran Ableton in her stems and her backing tracks all at once.
Wow.
And then running time code a lot of times, depending on the tour, if it's a huge production tour, running time code out of Ableton as well to sync up with the lighting and the cameras and other stuff that's going on. Or running OSC, I guess, for the lighting and then time code for your cameras. It's a lot of stuff, but it depends. It really depends on the artist. It can change.
So, and playback engineering is obviously you're on tour all the time. So for anybody that's listening right now, that might be interested and kind of trying to figure out what they want to do with their music career path and what they want to strive for, what is playback engineering like most ideal for? Like, what kind of person, what kind of things do you like, or like, should they be interested in? It sounds like if you're really into live shows, if you're down to be on stage with the artist, maybe even, like, what kind of things would you recommend, or like kind of traits that would be best for a playback engineer?
Have like thick skin and be able to work with some divas and know how to work with people and be a good communicator. and I guess be really good, maybe not sleeping and being in high stress environments. I'm selling it really well right now, I feel like, but but those are all real things, I guess.
But like, I mean, you're like, if you said you're on the stage a lot of the times, like you're not just in the back sometimes.
It depends. It depends on the show. And like I said, like, you know, for Da Vinci, for example, like he's also the drummer. Peter Dyer, who is an amazing keyboardist, plays for American Idol. He was on my podcast as well. And he plays sometimes keys on stage supporting the artist and does the playback. So, you know, it just depends. You know, I think you are actually more valuable as an instrumentalist in the playback world. Depending, you know, if you've really vibe with the artist. I know a handful of people and friends in the industry who are just like, yo, you're a really dope drummer and you can do all this for the tour and the band. I would love to have you come with us, you know, and that's a real thing. So I think that makes you more valuable if you wanted to get into that as a career. Somebody, it can be lonely on the road. I think like if you're traveling all the time, you know, if you have a family and you got two kids and a dog and you want the studio white picket fence dream, like probably not for you. Cause you just never know when you're going to be gone or get a call and have to be on the road. So
and let's get to the real reason why someone might want to do this, because it's connected with live shows. I assume that there's more money than a home studio involved.
There can be. Yeah. Yeah, depending on who you're working for, there could be, yeah, it can be a pretty good paying career path.
What's the demand like right now for playback engineers?
Well, I'll say it's definitely better than it was a year ago. That's for damn sure. I mean, because of COVID and everything, man, it was wild. A lot of people have just been sitting around since then. It's been hard.
But I mean, like for right now, I feel like culturally, like the supply of people wanting to be engineers and producers is much higher than the demand and the need for them.
Yeah.
What about for playback engineers? Is there, because this is something that I do music full time and I don't think I've ever heard of a playback engineer. So this is wild to me. I don't know anything about this industry.
Totally. It's booming, man. It's really exploded. You know, I'm 32. I started getting into the playback thing like 2.5 years ago. So it's, for me, it's still a little fresh. I mean, there's people who have been doing it for a long time. They used to call them space bars. That was like the joke back in the day, because literally like it was in Pro Tools, and a lot of times, you know, in Pro Tools was like the number one main DAW that, years ago, and like for any kind of playback on stage. So you just hit space bar, and then what you hit play, you just go. Like that's the show, right? And then now with like technology and like, you know, DAWs have evolved, and especially with Ableton Live, you can be a lot more flexible in your sets and improvise. So it's become a specialty really on stage too, setting up live performance and also syncing lights. But it's definitely a growing industry, man. It's booming for sure, more now than I think it ever has, especially now that shows are really starting to come back and venues are getting booked up like crazy, it seems like. So
this is incredible. That's incredible. That's really cool. I've literally, like, I feel really ignorant right now. I've never heard of a playback engineer, and I'm really
glad cool,
brought
man.
This up.
It's a thing.
So let's say someone listening right now wants to get into it. What are the first steps? Like, what do you do? What are there, like, YouTube channels or, like, obviously your podcast? Like, what are some ways that someone can kind of get into it?
Yeah, man, I think two things. I think number one is just get really fast at using a software like Ableton Live.
Is it exclusively Ableton that world? Or
I would say definitely probably 90% Ableton and then maybe like 10% main stage. There's like still, you know, I might be biased.
Main stage being like the Logic counterpart, right?
Kind of, yeah. 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 I mean, some people like drawing a huge blank. There's a couple people out there that use Logic, but Ableton's really built for live performance, especially with both session and arrangement views. Gives it more versatility. But I think, you know, Bitwig is another one too, but it just, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to be as common or popular in that playback world. But definitely I'd say, for advice, anybody that wants to get into it, I would say get really fast at using a DAW like Ableton Live. And because you never know, like people will throw stuff at you. You'll be side stage and the show starts in 5 minutes. They're like, hey, can you actually just cut out that song? And then we'll just like have this transition different. And you're like, oh, cool. We're playing in 5 minutes. Yeah, that sounds great. Let me just do like 20 minutes of work in 5 minutes, you know, and just like go in and you do it. You just have to be quick. So that's the thing. Just get really fast at it. And then also go to shows. Like if you don't already have connections with bands or in the genre that maybe you want to work with, just start going to shows and supporting the shit out of that artist. And if they're not already huge and there's like gatekeepers and stuff, like just maybe go up to them after the show, like start smaller, you know, like a mid-cap venue, go there, stick around, wait until people are tearing down, go introduce yourself, say, hey, I'm like really getting into playback. Would love to just do like a free session with you and maybe show you how I could optimize some of your live setup, or, you know, if they're not already using a laptop on stage.
And how do you go and learn what the heck optimizing your live setup even is?
Yeah, no, for sure. So I
like
do
from like, I'm talking like baby steps, like,
yeah, no, I do teach. I mean, this is going to be like shameless promo, but
please,
I do teach through my website, liveproducersonline.com. I have a master class as well for anybody who wants to do like a year mentorship with me. And it really depends on the person and what they're wanting to do. So that there's a lot to learn in that field. So I would say if anybody who's really serious about it, that could be an option. Or I also have like a membership where you can just at your own pace learning. I have a course on how to set up live performances in Ableton Live already. It's pretty cheap, free 7-day trial. So
what was that website one more time?
Yeah, it's liveproducersonline.com.
Dope.
And awesome. Also, if you're already in LA, then like yourself, then Laura Escade has MasterTrack. And she also has another course that she does for people who want to get into that as well. She's a good friend. So I have to shout her out too. And she's taught me a lot.
Yeah. Dope. Awesome. So I have to do a shameless pitch now as well.
Do it.
We'll take turns. I'd like to take a moment right now to thank our sponsors real quick. Thank you for sponsoring the podcast. First up, let's talk about Isotope. Do you ever use Isotope in your shows or in your productions and stuff?
Not for live performance, but definitely. I actually use Insight too for balancing some of the track volume.
There you go. I use Insight all the time, like Insight for the metering and like volume and
love it.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it's great.
And I know that when we were talking about mastering earlier, not only is that great to like kind of measure LUFS, like, but I use Ozone a lot in both mixing and in mastering.
Same.
So there you go. So thank you so much for sponsoring Isotope. If you're interested in purchasing some Isotope products, go to isotope.com/mmpodcast and use the code MMPOD10 to get 10% off your next order. Once again, that's isotope.com/mmpodcast, code MMPOD10. That is not including monthly subscriptions or the Spire hardware unit. Also, as always, thank you so much to FilePass. FilePass is the online software, just like Dropbox, where you can share files with clients or with anybody. You can set up paywalls so they can't download it unless the client pays for it, so no more leaky runaway files and leaks in your income anymore. And it's absolutely great. And unlike Dropbox and Google Drive, during playback, it plays full resolution wave files, so they get the full listening experience. So for that, go to mixingmusicpodcast.com and then click on our sponsors list, and you can see the website FilePass. I mean, I could keep going. We can keep going on about the playback stuff, but what else? Like, what are you kind of like going back to on your podcast? Like, what kind of topics do you just keep returning back to? Because you feel like it's so important that people just have a hard time understanding.
Dude, honestly, so one of my favorite recent podcasts was, I already mentioned him, Da Vinci, and he talks about the flow state. And I feel like the whole mental side of music is something that people don't talk about enough. You know, like we could sit here and go to YouTube University all day on our own and learn and stretch our minds and like find out little production hacks and little like technical tweaks and tips. But like, honestly, man, I feel like the mental side of producing is a lot of times the hardest part. It's just getting out of your own head. And he shares a lot of really good tips with that. But one, like speaking of the technical side, like one thing, one tip that I always use with it, with mixing or producing or anything, is if you play with it more than three times and you don't know what's up or down, you're fine. Just move on. So I've kind of adopted that philosophy. If I'm like playing with some compressor setting, you know, I've got everything dialed in, attack release, but I'm just like, I'm playing with the threshold. I was like, maybe a little more, maybe less, maybe I'm tired, maybe I haven't slept in 2 days. And you've heard the same song 642 billion times. And you just like, you just can't get it. And you're like, it just doesn't feel, just move on. It's okay. Like, cause if you keep playing with it more than three times, I'm just like, no, I'm all right. I'm just going to move on. And then if I need to come back to it another time, I will.
Yeah.
So that's, absolutely. That's, I think as a workflow, it's easy to get in your head and just, you don't even know what's up or down anymore sometimes. So that was always been helpful for me. And then as far as getting in the flow state as a producer, like you said, a lot of people in this podcast are producers. I think like comparison kills creativity a lot of times. So for me, like I will always, usually when I'm mixing or I'm like towards the end of the production stage of a song, I like to tune my ears. I know you've talked about this on the podcast before, but just like referencing tuning in your ears, trying to get into that moment. And then sometimes like I'll go into my track and maybe the song I just listened to and referenced is maybe in a different genre. And I just go into my song. And it's like, oh, it doesn't feel the same or whatever, but like I'm giving myself more permission for that to be okay. Like, and just really make music that I love more than trying to compare myself to other people's tracks all the time, you know? And if it sounds good, it sounds good. Like I could play with the same thing for 6 years, but now I'm just trying to release more music and just get into the flow of like making music that makes me happy and not being so concerned about what everybody else thinks about it, which can be tough. It's a real thing. Seems like
no,
Dr.
It really is. It yeah. really is like the mental health part, you know, staying healthy with it. It's super important.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's one of the reasons why, like, I respect artists so much. Cause I think like the normal average person will look at someone that seems very narcissistic and dumb. But what I see is like a strength. Like, I mean, like in the sense that, especially with people that kind of are a little bit more self-aware, right?
Mm-hmm.
We know that the answer is to not care. Like, don't care what anybody else thinks. And I've said this before on the podcast. I've said, the moment you start caring and doing things for other people is the moment you stop doing it, stop becoming an artist. And like, in that, like, and truthfully, even if we understand that fully, to do it on purpose is a whole nother story. Like,
yeah.
To just not care and to just like be you authentically.
Yeah.
First off, you need to figure out what you is after being pretending to be somebody else for all your entire life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Being a consumer. All right. And then on top of that, like, you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
And this is, it's so when I see, when someone talks crap on an artist, like, let's say, like Lil Pump, who is famously ignorant, or like 6ix9ine, you know, like,
yeah,
just like famously ignorant. And, what I see is a superpower called blissfulness. And maybe they got it on accident without choice because they're not as self-aware, but I can't do it on purpose even though I am more self-aware.
Yeah.
Like, I can't. And yeah. oh boy, how much would I give to do it on purpose?
Hmm.
To do it at all.
Yeah.
So I think that is a huge, I really respect artists that are willing to sacrifice so much and
yeah.
give so much for that.
Yeah, I think it's a hard thing too, man. It depends on who you're producing for too, right? Because if you're a ghostwriter or a ghost producer, you know, you've got commercial interests you need to work towards as well.
Oh, so absolutely.
That, you know, but if you're just making music for yourself as an independent artist, then yeah, fuck all that, dude. Just like do you and make music that you love and go down your own path and stay true to you. Yeah, I'm a firm believer in that as well, for sure.
There was a... oh gosh, what is his name? I was mentioning him on a previous episode, but there's a quote from a book that I was reading recently that talked about that, and I have totally lost it.
That's
I'm
okay.
Have to cut this out.
I do that all the time. I do that all the time.
I totally lost
That's
it.
So funny.
Oh, I remember. I remember what it was. It was to have practical empathy.
Oh, okay.
Like you gotta have, like, you can't just do it for yourself. And granted, like, you can't not be influenced by anything. So it's like, if you were to do something totally unaccepted by anybody else, that's a little bit different. But I mean, you gotta have a practical amount of empathy. I think that I think that's what you're talking about. Like, with a ghostwriter, with a songwriter, producer, like, you can't just be totally selfish and like, this is for me and make it sound like shit. You can't.
Yeah.
But like, especially as an artist or a songwriter, producer, is like, you, I feel like your job is to be, to emote for people who are unable to on their own.
Yeah.
And to just like any artist in all forms of artistry, right? Even outside of audio and music, to introduce and normalize new perspectives. Right. I think it was, there was a, I don't care how you feel about the dude. I love his talks on creativity. Jordan Peterson did an interview with an art curator in Canada for college, and he talked about creativity and what that means and how most people truly aren't creative. And like anybody can imagine things and like see things in their mind if they try really hard. But to like, I assume just like you and I, like, if we were being told you have to work a 9-to-5 and work for somebody else for the rest of your life, we will die. You know, like, you can't. You can't, right? And he talks about with creativity, like, when cubism was a thing. When it first came out, people would come into these art exhibits and would physically react in anger. Like, oh my gosh, this isn't art. Like, what is this? And they would get angry at a visual image. And now they sell cubist artwork at Target for $20 a dime. You know, $20 for a pack of 10.
Yeah.
Like, it's super normal. So it's the artist's, it may take a long time, but I feel like it's the artist's job, and thus the producer, and thus the engineer, and all of our combined efforts to introduce and normalize new perspectives into the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I think
that's a hard job.
It is a hard job. Especially when I think a lot of artists have to wear a lot of hats these days that maybe they didn't before. I mean, you got to have your social media on point. If you want to continue to stay engaged with fans, you got to, like, you know, set up your song for distribution after you spend dozens and dozens of hours creating it. You have to create a little marketing plan of how you're going to reach people with the song who maybe haven't heard it before. If you don't have a label backing you, you have, you know, so many things you got to do, and it can be really overwhelming. But I think that's why, and actually this is going down a whole nother rabbit trail right now. I'm just like, this is cool. I'm into it, dude. We're both ADD. This is, we should have expected this. It's just like going down. No, but I started realizing that I wasn't releasing as much music, and it wasn't because I didn't have time, but I was using time as an excuse. And I was recognizing, have you ever heard of the book called The War of Art?
The War of Art. I have heard of it, but I have not read it.
Somebody, I forget who it was on my podcast, mentioned it to me. And so I just bought it because I heard it like three times from three different people. But he talks about resistance as an artist and how resistance is really the core of why you don't accomplish your dreams as an artist and move forward and reach your goals. And he talks about, one of the first things he talks about is procrastination. And I find myself, I used to do this all the time without even realizing it subconsciously. But he says procrastination is the most common manifestation of resistance because it's the easiest to rationalize. And we don't tell ourselves, I'm never going to write my symphony. Instead, we say, I'm going to write my symphony, but I'm also going to just do it tomorrow instead. So you just kind of push it off, right? And it's just really interesting. His perspective in the book of talking about maybe like our motivations and why we don't accomplish our goals with music, and how procrastination a lot of time is just kind of a way we rationalize ourselves to not actually do it in the first place.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's good, man. And I think, I don't know, all the people out there listening, it's funny. I'm sure if you've been producing music for a while, you've listened to like some of your old tracks that like maybe you were first producing and you're like, holy shit, I'm so glad I'm where I'm at now. Because back then you're like, this is dope. Like, I just made this banger. It's awesome. And then, you know, fast forward 4 or 5 years, like you would go back and listen to that track and be like, oh, there's like 6 billion things I would fix, you know, because like with time builds experience. And so like, I just encourage anybody out there, if you get frustrated with your mixing, if you get frustrated with your producing, Like, you just got to put in the time and find a way to practice loving practice. I think that's like, that's the key, man, is like, if you can find a way, you may hate it and that's fine. You probably will at some point, but if you can find a way to continue to stay in love with doing it for the sake of just doing it and not being so concerned with like the likes or the follows or all the fandom that might come with it, which can still be a motivator. That's okay. But if you're doing it for the sake of doing it for just the love of doing it and then love the practicing to get to that place that you want to be, that's like the key to success. If you could just figure out a way to love practicing, which I love Melodics. Have you ever played with Melodics, that desktop app?
I have not.
It's fun. You can plug in like any MIDI controller almost or electronic drum set. It's like Guitar Hero, but for like professional producers.
Huh.
Yeah, it's fun. Like, disclaimer, they actually sponsor my podcast, but I do love them. Like, I'm just saying it because I think they're great. It's a fun product. But yeah, they make practicing fun. It's a good time.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. That's a big message in the book, that the practical empathy, where that came from. I just remembered it's The Practice by Seth Godin.
Yeah. Yeah.
He talks a lot about that, like the practice, about enjoying the process of what you can control, and what you can't control is the results.
Yeah. Dude, that's
and going
true.
Back to what you were saying, like the artist now, especially like the performer, right? And how their job now and how wildly different it is. Like, there's so many producers out there, and producing production as a job has just gotten so much more skillful, and people have just gotten so good at it that the need for an artist to be very musical and talented as a singer or as a guitar player, as a drummer, has gotten lower and lower on the priority list. And I just want to mention this to kind of flip it around, because I see a lot of people online like complaining about it, like being really bummed about it. It's like, oh, pop music sucks nowadays and all that jazz. And the fact of the matter is, it still takes a lot of talent to make music like that, to produce music that people like. I mean, like, I guarantee you, you know how difficult it is to write a song that people like, you know, or whatever that is.
Yeah, right?
Because you can't just copy it.
It's true. It's funny, man. And, go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, like, as well as, like, I think that the reason why, like, artistry and, like, talent, like, there's way too many buckets you have to fill. Like you said, you have to be social media guy. You have to be really into acting and, and or actress or whatever. And you have to be into fashion and design. You have to be into artwork. You have to be a performer, which is a different performer entertainer, which is a different skill from a musician.
Yeah.
You have to be well-spoken and comedic. Like, you have to have people like planning your life and being okay with some sort of inflexibility with your schedule. You have to go on tour. Like, there's way so much that you have to handle.
Yeah.
And it all requires a team. And the fact of the matter is, because there's so many people wanting to do music because it's such a cool job to have.
Yeah.
The quality of the supporting teams around them, including like jobs like your own and mine, have just gotten so good. I mean, even in the mixing world, I mean, you listen to a record that was made in like the 70s and the 80s, and then you listen to a home record that was made by some local amateur dude.
Yeah.
It's going to sound wildly better.
Oh, totally.
Just because of like
technology.
Just because of technology.
It's dumb.
Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's like there's such a new world, and we can't really complain about the artists. Like, we can't. We shouldn't be.
Right.
Because they're the ones that are providing jobs and sacrificing more for us than anything. Like, without
That's
artists,
true.
We wouldn't be here. So,
I mean, I totally agree, man.
I kind of ranted.
I'm here for it. No, that's tight. I agree. I totally agree. I think that's another reason why it's really important for people to recognize maybe what's the best way to make a music career for them. Because if you aren't like super social, maybe you don't want to play shows. Maybe you don't even want to produce a lot of music and have to worry about the headache of releasing it and doing your own artist label thing. You know, maybe somebody who's a little more introverted, they don't want to play shows. Maybe they want to make a fat paycheck for licensing. You know, if they do sync, you know, sync licensing, if you can get in on the sync deal, there's a lot of money to be made in certain circles there for sure. As a producer, like writing for, if you got like even just a 30-second jingle on Netflix or something, you could be getting checks in the mail for a little while. It's pretty nice. So, I mean, there's a lot of different a lot of different ways to make a career doing music too.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Like with the internet, it's like there's just so many ways you can provide for yourself just making music in any capacity now, it seems like.
That's right. Dan, one more time real quick, what is the name of your website?
Yeah, man. It's liveproducersonline.com. Also, I produce music as Philia. If anybody likes electronic, funky, bass-infused music.
Like future funk?
A little future funky, but I guess a little more experimental bass-infused into funk kind of side. I don't even know. Isn't that the worst? And people are like, what's your genre, man? It's like, well, it's a little bit of this and like five other things mixed into it. Yeah, no, but that's, yeah, Philia Music. So that's the handle, at Philia Music. I'm on the gram mostly, but
dope.
If anybody wants to
hang out.
Is that
your main account on Instagram?
Yeah, that's dope. Where I hang out a lot.
And as well as if you're listening and you're interested in any of the things that we talked about today, go check out Ableton Music Producer Podcast. I assume it's available on Spotify and Apple.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 that jazz.
The interweb, pretty much anywhere. Yeah, for
cool.
Sure.
Well, Dan, if next time you come out to LA, make sure you hit me up. I'm gonna get you on the gram.
Dude, absolutely,
and,
man.
You have to hit me up. I'm gonna get mad if you don't hit me up if you're in LA.
Well, I'll be pissed. I'm in Indianapolis for the time being. We'll see how long that lasts right now because of COVID and everything finally going back to normal or whatever normal is. But yeah, dude, if I'm in LA, which will probably be a lot more often now, then yeah, I'll definitely hit you up. We'll hang out. It'll be fun. We'll nerd out on some Isotope and shit.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Mixing Music Podcast. To everybody listening, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
Later.
1, 2, 3.
Are you trying to find the perfect distribution platform to get your music on Spotify and Apple? I personally use and love DistroKid. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/DistroKid to get a small discount and get access to a platform with unlimited uploads for a yearly fee. Happy uploading and enjoy the show.